Philosophy 103C, Wednesday, October 11th, 2017. Okay, so is there anybody here who did not get your essay back? Is there anybody here who wrote more on your essay than I did? Well, how many lines did you write, and how many lines did I write? On the essay I just returned to you, Ms. Pagan? You did? How much did I write? 10 to 15 lines? That was relatively little, actually. Some I wrote more than others for whatever reasons. So anyway, that was the point of making that claim, which may not be a true claim, that I wrote more than you did. In some instances, I probably did. But I wrote a lot. So, in effect, I gave each of you a tutorial. As if you were, instead of telling you what to do in class, which I think I did, but I told you in much more detail individually on your essays. So if you want to improve them, you need to engage in that tutorial, because my writing it there is only the start, and it doesn't mean anything if you don't read it and think about it and take it seriously. So of course you can read it and think about it and take it seriously and still be confused on some points. I'm not saying that everything that I wrote there should be completely clear, but it should give you more direction. Many of the essays were simply not on the topic. And my feeling was that some of you are used to the, you know, being given an assignment on a book, and anything you write on the book is, it's up to you. Certainly that's the impression given by many of the essays. When I say many, I don't mean the majority, but it was more than a few. Furthermore, what most of you don't know how to do very well is learn from a book. That's quite a statement. So those who did pay attention to the essay topic, well, they looked at the topic and they asked themselves, what have I got to say about this topic? Which may seem common sense. What else are you supposed to do? A couple of people didn't ask themselves, they asked some internet source. They of course got F's. I don't know if that's true for anybody here. I didn't have many, but I had a few. So of course, you need to turn to yourself. In a sense, I mean, who else is supposed to do it? But the question is not what you think about these things, it's what Plato thinks about these things. So when you're given a topic, what you want to do is ask yourself, you know, where does he talk about that? But a more basic even than that is that you were given a problem. And I said specifically in the first paragraph, state the problem, and that is the essay topic, and clarify it, but don't say a single word trying to solve it. You have to make a distinction between understanding a question you've been asked and having the answer. right? Somebody might say, how do you get to JFK from here? And you understand what that means, but you don't know. Perfectly reasonable. So the first thing you have to do is understand the question. If you begin with the question, if you begin with a problem, that will help to take you out of the frame of mind in which you think that you're supposed to have the answer to the question. Somebody asks you a question, you're supposed to have the answer. If you don't have the answer, something's wrong with you as a student or whatever. And often what students do in a situation like that, because they are being evaluated, if they don't have the answer, they'll make one up. Sort of, as we say, do the best you can. Well, all of that is common sense too, but it leaves out something else that's common sense, which is that when you don't know something, you do what? You don't know something and you need to know it, what do? You what? Ask? Those are possibilities, but they're it's much more general. What? You try to find out. I mean, isn't this the age in which, you know, whenever I ask my wife a question now, she says, search it. Right? She didn't tell me anything anymore. This is the age of searching, isn't it? Now, some forms of searching don't develop your understanding. They may give you information, they may give you an answer, but they don't develop your understanding because it is what you just said. You ask and somebody tells you. You have no idea whether it's true or not. It may look like a good answer. But other forms of searching are themselves forms of thinking. Somebody gives you a bunch of numbers and says, what do they add up to? You don't have the answer, but you know how to get it, don't you? How? I just gave you an easy example so that you could practice a little. Somebody's giving you a bunch of numbers, 40 or 50 numbers, says, what does this add up to? You don't have the answer, do you? Is there anybody here who can do that like that, see 50 numbers right away and get the answer? So what do? What does calculated mean? What do? What? Get a calculator. That's like asking somebody else. So what you just did was throw out my example. Because although it is an example of finding out something you didn't know, it's not one in which you have to think. It's like asking somebody. It's like Googling. What was the year that Protestant Christianity began in Europe? Anybody know the answer to that question? Protestant Christianity. Protestant Christianity began as a protest. That's why they were called Protestants. Protestants against the church. Who was the person who made the first protest that got the Protestant religion started? Anybody know the answer to that? Yes. And do you know how many theses he had? Points making against the church, demanding reform. 95. And where were they posted? Posted on a church door. In what city? What? No, he was posting them against Rome, but it was in Wittenberg, Germany. What year? 1517. So you see, the point is this. Data like that are not the products of thought. Either you know them or you don't, and if you don't, you have to know the source to go to that does know. And that's what computers are so good at, because they've got all that kind of information or access to it, and they can get answers for us. And therefore, they are potentially liberating for thought because you don't have to spend a lot of time doing stuff that isn't thought. It liberates you from menial tasks. Except that what human beings have discovered in the modern world is that the inventions that liberate us from tasks enslave us to themselves. And we spend all our time doing mindless stuff instead of being liberated from doing mindless stuff. We now do mindless stuff that we don't have to do, but we do it because mindless is the way we're comfortable. And thinking is uncomfortable. I mean, goodness gracious, look what happens to some of these real good thinkers. People kill them, right? Okay, so that's why I can't accept that answer. So here's what you do. When somebody gives you a bunch of numbers, you take them one digit at a time. Isn't that how we were taught to add? If you're adding numbers like this, and I said 50 numbers, right? You don't usually add them all together, although, you know, people who are good with numbers can do it quickly, right? And geniuses can do things that we, you know, we're amazed. How do you do that, you know? But what we do is 4 and 9 is 13. I'm going to put down the 3 and carry the 1, right? What? I don't care about that. But if you want to show off, that's all right. No, you're not, because that's not the problem I'm talking about. It's an illustration, right? What this illustrates is a procedure. You go step by step. So thinking is like walking. You get where you're going by taking steps. But you have to go in the right direction, or else you don't get where you're going. You have to take the right steps. So when you start out with a problem, the problem tells you something about where to go to solve it. The problem you were given in this essay was, Socrates says two things. I won't or wouldn't, because it's counterfactual, obey a law that forbids, that's the abbreviation I used in your essays. What is that? What is that? But what is that? Do you know what that symbol is? No, it's got a line through it. Oh, it's the letter phi from Greek. And I use it all the time. I mean, you don't have to learn Greek to read this Greek philosopher, but you know, people in fraternities and sororities all over the world know these letters without knowing any Greek. So he says he wouldn't obey a law that forbids philosophy. And then he also says, do not break laws even to save your life. Okay? Now this one he says in the Apology. This one he says in the Crito. So the first paragraph, and that's this symbol, right? Your first paragraph should point out that these two. Now, so what some of you did was you repeated the essay topic, which is fine. You know, that you have in your syllabus. But most people didn't add any comment on that at all. Now, you wouldn't have to, but if you're thinking about a problem, not how to solve it, just what the problem means, it's helpful sometimes if you notice some things about it. Many students told me, confusing Socrates with Dr. King or some modern civil disobedience person, Gandhi or Thoreau, the American 19th century philosopher who wrote on civil disobedience, that Socrates won't obey any law that he thinks is unjust. Well, that's an interesting position, but it's not Socrates. In the Crito, Socrates very clearly says that it's wrong to break a law. Okay? But here, in the apology, he says that if there were a law against philosophy, he would break it. And he says it also another way. He says to them, if you say to me, okay, Socrates, we don't want to punish you. Just promise us that you won't do it again, which is what authorities often say to people who are a thorn in their side or something. They don't want to, like kids that misbehave or something like that. You might say to them, okay, just control yourself. Don't do it again, and it'll be okay. Now, if the person that you're trying to discipline in that way agrees with you that what he's done is wrong, you've got a chance that that'll work, assuming the person has some self-control. But Socrates doesn't think that what he's doing is wrong. However, he has said over here that you should obey the law. You shouldn't decide what's right and what's wrong and do whatever you want to. That's not his position. There's only one reason to break the law, according to what Socrates says. And that's what something that you could notice before you even try to understand why he's saying these things. What's the one thing that you should not give up, even if there's a law against it? Philosophy, right. So what that tells you, the reader, the thinker, the writer, is that you're going to have to find out what's so damn special about philosophy. According to Socrates, you don't ever have to be convinced of any of these things. You're trying to understand this author. According to Socrates, what's so special about philosophy? Okay. Now, what I'm trying to do is illustrate what it means to think about the question before you go about trying to answer it. And what I said to you in class was that when you finish that first paragraph, which is a statement of the problem that you're going to try to solve, that the method of trying to solve it, since you're trying to understand two things that a person has said that don't seem to fit together, and the answer might be, well, he's a human being. He contradicted himself. One time he thought one thing, and another time he said something else, and he didn't even realize maybe that he contradicted himself. That's one possibility. But when you're trying to understand what a human being has said to you, whether it's in conversation with a living human being or reading a book, when that's your task, the answer to the question is, first and foremost, there may be other resources as well, but first and foremost, it's the book itself. So if Socrates says something in the apology, the way to understand it is to look at the apology and see if taking this sentence, which in the problem is taken out of context, it's not that in asking you this question, I'm trying to distort what he said. You know how politicians and other celebrities are always complaining that their statements were taken out of context. At least half the time, that's just an excuse, you know, after they've discovered that what they've said got them in trouble. But some of the time, it's a legitimate excuse. That is to say, if you take a person's words, a few of his words, out of their relationship to other things the person has said, you can change the meaning, right? So, for example, somebody might say, I do not believe in white supremacy. And then you can quote him as saying, believe in white supremacy. I just said those words, didn't I? But you left out the I do not believe in. Makes a difference. Now, usually the issues are not so simple. I'm just trying to illustrate. So the hope is that you'll go back to the apology, see where Socrates says, where he talks about philosophy, and understand why he thinks that no law against it should be obeyed. Then go to the Crito, where he talks about no law should be broken, and see why he says that. And then, so the first thing is the problem, the second thing is one part, you know, the one part of the problem in the apology, the third thing is the other part of the problem in the Crito, and then bring them together again and see if they can fit better now that you have a little more understanding of what they mean. Okay, so what I'm trying to say to you about that now is that you need to think of the book as the place where you get your information. What many of the essays seem to be doing as I read them, I can't read your minds, but I got that impression, is that, you know, you were asked the question and now you're doing the best to answer it. That is to say, you're looking for the answer within yourself. Now, the resources for getting the answer have to be within yourself. But that doesn't mean you do it without the book. You go back to the apology. So, for example, where does Socrates talk about philosophy? Anybody remember? Okay, so that's a hard thing to remember. Even harder than Martin Luther and his 95 theses in 1517. To remember where things are in a book like the Apology, you have to have some idea of how it's organized, right? So the Apology is about a trial, right? What's the first part of the trial? No, but of any trial, what would the first part be? Of course, we have speeches on both sides. This apology doesn't have the speeches from the accusers. Only when Socrates, what we would call, cross-examines them. But what do you start with? So what are you working on there? No, but what is it about? What? Yeah, and whether the person charged is guilty or not. Yeah, so the first thing is the verdict. And that's true in this one too. And then after the verdict is in, there's sentencing, right? Because you can be found guilty and maybe it'll cost you $50 or maybe it'll cost you 2 years in jail or maybe it'll cost you your life, who knows? So sentencing is a second related but distinct issue. Okay, so this piece of writing by Plato has three parts in that sense. It has the verdict part, which is the biggest part. Then it has the sentencing part where they offer different penalties, which is their procedure. And then after the sentence comes in, death, we have Socrates addressing the judges, the ones that were for him, the ones that were against him. He has different marks to each. So it breaks up into those three parts. But the first part is by far the biggest. There's interesting, important stuff in the others, but the first part is the biggest. And that's why it's sometimes called Socrates' defense. Now, Socrates begins his defense by distinguishing old accusers from new accusers. You have to remember that if you want to have a sense of this, what goes on in this dialogue. But each of those breaks up into two parts. The old accusers made charges against him, not in the formal sense of taking him to court, but in the sense that there were things they accused him of and talked about it publicly. This is his reputation that he's talking about as if it were a courtroom thing, which is a good analogy for a reputation because, in fact, people speak now, use the expression of being tried in the court of public opinion. Right? When people have opinions about you, that can affect your life as much or even more as a courtroom. So he talks about the charges. That is to say, the things that people accuse him of. And then, and he more or less dismisses those. There's not much to them. They might be true of other people, but anybody who knows Socrates knows that's not what he does. It's like accusing somebody of dirty play in football, and he's not a football player. Right? Maybe he's done some dirty stuff, but it isn't in the football field. And anybody who knows him knows that. So it's not, that's not that hard to defend against. It's like a defense where there's a crime committed here, but you were out of the country. Sounds like it was hard for you to have done it, right? If you weren't even there. So he finds it easy to defend himself against that, his reputation. But he then raises a question. It's not part of his reputation, but it's about his reputation. The question is, okay, if you didn't do those things, why do so many people say you did? Not everybody has a big reputation like that, you know. You must have been doing something. That doesn't mean you must have been doing something bad, but you must have been doing something to attract attention, that people would be talking about you rather than Joe Blow, right? So Socrates, this is his maneuver. It's not the prosecution who does that. He shifts the attention from the specific charges, which are, to the question of what kind of a life did he live. So he has made his burden, in a sense, greater, but it's the burden he chooses, which is not to defend himself as a person from specific charges, but to defend his life as a philosopher. So that means it's in that second part. So we have charges like impiety or whatever right here, but here we have philosophy. So it's in that second part that you, the student writing about why Socrates, see, remember, don't forget the topic. The topic, you weren't told, just write some stuff about the apology, anything you like. I do tell you to do that kind of thing occasionally. For the logs, I give you, every log has a topic, right? But when you're absent from class, I tell you to make up for the absence, listen to the podcast, and write what you think some of the main ideas were. So there, you have a certain freedom of topic that isn't the case with the other assignments. So if you are trying to learn, that learning might be partly remembering, but it's likely to be fresh learning too as you sit down to write this essay, because having to write an essay that you get graded on captures your attention, if you care about being, you know, grades and being a good student at all. It captures your attention in a way that may not always get captured by just the daily routine of being a student. So now you say to yourself, oh, I better look back at that place where he says he's a philosopher. Now, I said to you, when you look at this problem, you realize that he's saying, obey the law unless it tells you not to do philosophy. That's the exception. And that should suggest to you, that he thinks there's something special about that, right? That's what I said before. So now you're going back to the apology, the story of the oracle, with that focus of mind. Why does Socrates think this is so damn important? Now, he tells a story of events that he didn't initiate. His friend did. And actually, if you think about the story, You can't take it too literally, because if the oracle had an opinion about Socrates, that is, if the god, speaking through the priestess at the oracle, had an opinion about Socrates, it must have been the case that Socrates was already doing stuff. Right? Whereas Socrates tells this story as if he did it all because the oracle told him to. But if you go a little deeper, you realize that what he's saying is, I've lived my life following a divine command. Now, this is tricky business. And many of you got caught up in a bad way on this. And I pointed out on many essays that there are lots of scoundrels in the world, murderous, nasty people who use God as their excuse. Just to say, if you do something, to say that God told you to do it, as far as I'm concerned, doesn't add to your case at all. Let me explain what I mean. First of all, did the oracle, did the god, as Socrates frequently says, the god, tell him what to do? So what did the god do that Socrates understood to be a command to do something? That's right. He gave him an evaluation, you could say. But he said Socrates is the wisest. Now, what was Socrates' reaction to that? I mean, if this were the Academy Awards or the Emmys or the Tonys or whatever, you'd just be excited. You'd say, oh my gosh, I finally won. No, he does not try to prove him wrong. That would be impious. It would be like saying, you may be a god, but you're a piss poor one. that could get you in trouble, right? No. You're on the right track, but he doesn't try to prove him wrong. Why does he have to prove anything? Mr. Kwan? He's puzzled. He doesn't understand. When he explains this to you a little bit, the conclusion he comes up with is that there's a difference between the divine and the human, right? The human knows what? Nothing. The God knows everything. That's Socrates' understanding of his relationship as a human being, not just as an individual, but as a representative human being, his relationship to the divine. The divine has all the truth. And what's our relationship to the truth? We're puzzled. Scientists see something happen and they don't know why. They're puzzled. It's our relationship to nature and everything else that we try to understand. Now, we may solve some puzzles. So you might say, well, they know a lot. Okay, well, we'll deal with that. But the story that Socrates is telling you is of a communication from the divine that he found puzzling. And that is life. We human beings do not understand. If you interpret it as a command, what is it a command to do? If somebody speaks to you, what command are they giving you by just the mere fact of speaking to you? And what? Listen and what? Well, before you respond even. Yeah, try to understand. Now, if it's another human being, they have a limited claim on you. They can't be giving you maybe commandments, you know? But still, it is a claim we make on each other when we speak to each other, to be taken seriously, to be listened to at least for a couple seconds. But this is from a god. And so Socrates feels commanded to understand what he's been told. And the only way he can understand what he's been told is to go out and find out what it means for him to be the wisest. Now, here's another thing you need to know. By the way, we need to finish the Meno. We're obviously not going to do it today. So we'll finish it Monday, all right? The last part of the Meno. What does the syllabus say we're supposed to be doing on Monday? We're supposed to be starting John Stuart Mill? The Phaedo?
Yeah.
Oh, no, yeah, we're not going to have time for the Phaedo. I knew that weeks ago already. So we'll finish the Meno on Monday. How many days were we given for the Phaedo in the syllabus?
Just one.
Yeah, okay, so we'll finish Plato on Monday. So, right. That's why I'm talking about the essay now. Okay, so you've got two different words here that the god uses and that Socrates uses. Wisdom and knowledge. They're not identical. But wisdom is a kind of knowledge. When we think of a person as wise, what do we have in mind? Mr. Morales? Well, that might be how the person got wise. But the reason we think of experience of what? What? Life, right. So what we mean by wisdom, and we may, you know, frequently we will disagree about who's got it and who hasn't got it, right? But what we mean by wisdom is some knowledge about how to live, about what's good. Notice how this story is told in those terms. Socrates is the wisest, so he's the best. When I make fun of this as a ranking system, what should Socrates spend his whole life just making sure that he's number one? Well, the answer in a sense is yes. The ranking is important in this way. Not that he could be proud to be number one, but that what we're talking about is the ranking of things as better and worse, good and bad. That's what wisdom is about. Now, if the god says that Socrates is number one with respect to wisdom, then whatever it is that Socrates knows, the god is saying is wisdom. The god is saying that Socrates is wise. Now, what does the god say is Socrates' wisdom? And I want you to notice that as we're talking about this, we're trying to say something that makes sense. That it's not just a commandment where the god tells Socrates to do something and we have no understanding why. Makes no sense to us, but we say, well, it's the god, so Socrates had to do it. That's what many of you wrote about. That's not the story Socrates presents. He presents a story in which the god says something that he didn't understand, and so he spent his life trying to understand it. In other words, he spent a life trying to understand the god. That's what his life consists in. But what is it that makes Socrates rank number one, so to speak? What does he know? Yes, that he knows nothing. And we learn that that's the difference between human and God, right? So Socrates knows the difference between human and God. Whereas these other people, by implication, those who think they know things, they're fudging that difference a little bit. Okay. Now the problem with that is that everything else we want to say about what Socrates is is doing involves him learning stuff. If we're going to say that this activity is beneficial when he goes around talking to people and not just destructive, they have to be able to learn something. They have to be able to acquire some knowledge. So this idea that he has no knowledge, except that he knows that he has no knowledge, is paradoxical, right? Both knows and doesn't know. We have to make that a little more flexible. And we have to recognize that human beings can gain knowledge, but that they never gain knowledge in the sense that they can say they know and they're done. That what they know is beyond learning more that would correct it and change it, and right? That belongs to the divine alone. To try to follow the command of the divine is to try to increase your knowledge. Now, I know we're running out of time, but I have to make one more point. The whole assumption of all of this is not only identifies truth and knowledge with the divine, but also with the good. So you have to think about what it is about knowledge that's good. And if you get some understanding about that, then you'll be able to understand Socrates' defense. What he's saying is, I spent my whole life seeking knowledge, and in doing so, and helping other people to do it too, in doing so, I've done the greatest service to Athens, greater even than the Olympic heroes whom he respects and admires, right? And so you have to appreciate what the benefit is of knowledge. So let me put it to you very simply. When he relates this to the laws and whether you should obey the laws or not, the laws need to be obeyed, because if they're not obeyed, they can't do any good at all. They're just ideas. It's like having an idea and not putting it in action, right? If you don't obey the laws. However, the laws also need to be questioned. Otherwise, they can't be good laws. You have to know something about what's good. If you're going to get something that really is good and not just some half-assed idea. That's what he's trying to get people to do. So that when Euthyphro thinks that he's doing the right thing with respect to his father, or Meletus thinks that Socrates is corrupting the youth, they have to learn to think about these things so that they can understand them, have knowledge, and what they think and do actually produces benefit to the youth, or whatever, produces piety, education, justice, and so on. Those are the things that Socrates spent his time questioning people about so that they could understand them better. To the extent that we're successful in doing that, we move towards the divine. We become more divine-like. All right, so this is Wednesday. We meet again on Monday. I think we're through with holidays for a while.